Welcome to Saving the Game. This is episode 11, Players Behaving Badly, recorded Thursday, December 6th of 2012, with your hosts Grant, Peter, and Brandon. Welcome to Saving the Game. I'm Grant.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Brandon.
This is episode 11. We're going to be discussing players behaving badly on this episode. But before we get into that, just wanted to remind you guys that we have a charity fundraiser going for PEG Partners. It's a really good charity that's run by musician David Lamott. There's information on that on our website. We've actually already reached our first goal. Thank you, listeners.
Yes, thank you. And we're now going for $250. We hit our 150 goal, like Peter said. I did want to mention, too, that two other podcasts that are part of the RPGpodcasts.com network of shows are doing holiday fundraisers as well. One is Happy Jack's RPGs podcast, which is raising money for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. They're a fairly sizable podcast, and to their credit, they're trying to raise $1,000 for the JDRF. So, good for them.
Odd little story about that. Yep. I actually stumbled onto their podcast while I was listening to either ours or Fear the Boot on Stitcher. It just rolled over, and I'm like, oh, I think this name sounds familiar. And all of a sudden, they were mentioning Saving the Game. And I was like, yeah!
Stitcher is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And Narrative Control, which is an on-again, off-again podcast of pretty high quality, is raising money for Doctors Without Borders. We'll have links to both of these podcasts in the show notes, as well as their charitable pushes if one of those appeals to you more than the PEG Partners fundraiser we're doing. The only thing I'll mention is that Happy Jack's RPG podcast, while its content is fantastic, How can I put this?
Listen with discretion.
Yeah.
You know how a little more mature.
We're on the very clean side of podcasts. They define the explicit tag. Just saying. So.
Today is, well, by the time this episode drops, we should be a couple days away from Christmas. Or maybe a couple days past Hanukkah, if I remember how that goes out in my head. But anyway, we're talking about an issue today that kind of goes in well with both those holidays, which are focused on getting presents and people being judged on being naughty or nice.
Really? Because I was under the impression that Christmas was the birth of our Savior and, you know, this deep reverent thing.
Yes, it's supposed to be. But in commercial holidays, as of right now, it's been really co-opted by Santa Claus. I mean, if you don't have to take my word for it, go outside and look.
Oh, I work in retail, believe me. I understand.
Yeah.
Are we sure we want to... I suppose if we're going to run with this, we might as well run with it. All right, so we've got some scripture for tonight's podcast, as usual. Brandon, do you want to take that first verse?
All right, 1 Samuel 2, verse 3. Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come forth from your mouth. For the Lord is the God of knowledge. And by him, actions are weighed.
Nice. And the second verse we've got is from the second chapter of James, verses 14 through 17. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. So, we mentioned the topic here, characters behaving badly and players behaving badly. And this is actually a topic that one of our listeners brought up on the Fear the Boot forums. We've got a thread over there that we get a few people posting in. This is from a guy whose username is D3M410, which I believe is pronounced DeMayo or DeMayo. I met him at Fear the Con 5 and... he told me how to pronounce his name, and I have subsequently forgotten it entirely, so I apologize for butchering this name again. But D3M410...
You dastardly monster.
I know. But D3M410 posted this in that thread, and I'm going to read it in full here. I've been running a game that seems to be a study in how RPGs might have to work extra hard to be Christian value-affirming, despite the fact that all involved are Christian and know each other through church. Anyway, I'm hoping that I can get some good advice on how to make morality a bit more pressing to the players so that mass genocide is not the default solution to problems.
So, basically, the characters are not behaving like good, decent, or even normal people, despite the fact that their character sheets say they're supposed to be good-aligned. Do I have that correct?
I think so. We're kind of working on the assumption that at least some of these characters are supposed to be good people. If mass genocide is the default solution to problems because they are genocidal maniacs in character, you're playing an interesting game, but I don't know that that's a problem necessarily, unless it's not at all the game the GM wants to run and that no one really wants to play.
Which it sounds like the GM does not want to run this game, so let's see if we can give him a little bit of help here.
Yeah, I think so.
To be fair, this is a problem for the ages. I mean, even good-aligned characters in many fantasy games that I've played in are perfectly fine with the genocide of, like, kobolds or goblins or stuff like that. They're seen as such non-entities. And we have to see is, where's the problem there? Are we talking about the complete you can't kill anything? Or are we talking about don't kill things that are screaming at you begging for mercy? Sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't want to get too far into that because I think treatment of of monstrous creatures in an RPG would be a great topic in and of itself. And maybe we'll come back to this later. I don't know. But let me say real quick that I think in that case, and I think more generally, it's ultimately all about the threat that something poses. And whether or not what you're genociding, to use that word here, is something that is always a threat to your society or whatever group you identify with or what have you, versus, hey, they kind of live on their own and don't bother anybody, but one of them annoyed me, so hey, they all gotta die. We kind of talked about this some actually way back in episode 3 with the Just War Theory discussion.
Yeah, a little bit.
Brandon, unfortunately, you weren't on that episode, but I think, Peter, you remember that.
My first thought on how to tackle this particular problem, to just kind of wade right in here, is if your player characters have been going up against things like orcs and kobolds and that sort of thing, which are often thought of as just kind of the cannon fodder of the fantasy world, give them enemies to fight that aren't quite as disposable seeming by the tropes of fantasy, and make it really uncomfortable for them to just hack their way through things. Like, you know, have them assault the bandit camp and have the bandits be human, and maybe have like some non-combatants with them that they, you know, they try and negotiate for the lives or try and, you know, help escape or try and shield while the fighting is going on, and make the players realize that they're being murderous and butchering people if they don't stop at that point. Have like another friendly group come through and just be horrified at the carnage and let them squirm. I mean, you know, if you're going to go and commit a full-fledged atrocity, it shouldn't be something that you feel fantastic about. Or if you do, something should come along and make you feel not fantastic about it in relatively short order.
Yeah. I think there's kind of a couple of things going on here. Let me first say, we're sort of working on the assumption this is a fantasy game, because I don't know anything about this game that D3M410 is running.
To be fair, like, what we're talking about so far could be applied to any setting at any time whatsoever.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. I just use fantasy because it's a standby, it's a trope, and I can talk about orcs and goblins and mean something.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean orc and goblins, but like, you know, mutants, if you're playing in a...
Whatever kind of the disposable cannon fodder enemy is. Now, I think it's important that if they actually are going up against something that is truly disposable and cannon foddery, like mindless undead or robots, that you not try to make them feel too terribly bad about that. because they're basically attacking inanimate objects at that point.
Right.
You might poke them a little bit about how expensive all these robots they're wrecking are, and, you know, like, this might be having a negative effect on some aspect of the local economy or something if they're, you know, supers and they're causing a lot of property damage or that sort of thing. But that right. doesn't sound like the problem that D3M410 is having here.
No, it honestly sounds like a problem that I have seen and in my younger days of gaming been a part of. I think this is unique to certain systems like D&D 3.0 and its similar products, you know, 3.5, Pathfinder, etc.
I wouldn't say unique, but I'd say more prevalent.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
I think one of the problems that you run into in a situation like D&D, where combat is not particularly deadly, is that there's a real temptation to play it like you're playing Diablo or Torchlight, where your character is not in any real severe danger of dying from a normal combat, and you can just chop through hordes of these puny little enemies and not really think about it. It almost has that same kind of action-y feel. And if D3M410 is trying to run a game that's a little more story-ish, or a little more morally complex than just a hack-and-slash Monty Hall kind of campaign, I think maybe that's where this is. I wonder if there's just some confusion about what kind of game is actually being played in his group.
Maybe, but here's the thing. You're right about the type of game that we're, again, sort of assuming he's running here, contributing to that sort of behavior. The other part of it is, you know the old adage about when all you have is a hammer, every problem
looks
like a nail?
Everything looks like a nail, yeah.
When you've got any sort of conflict or any sort of problem, when you're, A, used to dealing with problems with violence, because most of the problems you confront are violent problems, and B, are power tripping because you're high-level characters and you have the forces of nature and the universe at your command or are a completely untouchable combat machine, even if you're not specializing heavily in that, most high-level characters are absolutely terrifying. A high-level bard who doesn't use any spells will beat the bejesus out of any normal combat.
Yeah, he will beat the ever-loving stuffing out of an entire regiment of first-level warriors.
Exactly.
He just will.
Yeah, he doesn't have to try very hard. It's just the way the mechanics of the game stack up. So you have that natural power tripping going on, and you have the fact that you're used to dealing with these problems in this particular way. So I think that's kind of the root cause of this. I get the feeling he's not just talking about combat scenarios here. I get the feeling he's talking about, why did you burn down the orphanage? It looked at me funny kind of problems.
Well, then, there's a couple different problems that it could be, and because we don't have all this information, we don't know.
Right.
And, you know, it might, what we've been saying might be true. Of course, it might not be his fault. I know in a game I'm running of Dresden, a lot of it in some characters is happening exactly like that. I have a guy whose first response is, I'm going to strap an explosives collar onto it that can't ever be taken off. I have a guy who just wants to shoot things in the head.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, and I've dealt with it in a whole lot of way by finding ways of going, now what you're doing is a problem.
Right.
I think one of the ways that we should look at this is solving how do we get more morals and stuff and to get character as to act good in a role-playing game. Why does someone have morals in the real world?
Boy, that's... Do we have the time to start a whole nother podcast? And I don't just mean an episode. I mean an entire whole nother podcast.
You're right. The problem is the scope of that is so big, I'm not sure we can adequately address it in one episode.
I completely agree.
I would think that you've got two basic approaches that you need to take in a situation like this one. First of all, you need to talk to people outside of the game, right? You need to actually go and speak to your players and say, hey, look, you're behaving in this certain way during the sessions. Your characters are acting in such a manner. I am trying to run a different kind of game. What you guys are doing is not okay.
Right.
And I think then once you've had that discussion with them, you need to back up what you have said out of character with what happens in character in the game.
Right.
So it's like, you know, if you can't just smash your way through every problem, when they try to smash their way through a problem, once play actually begins again, there needs to be consequences right there.
Well, right there, but I think also down the road, there need to be consequences. The nice thing about that is, if they have been acting like this for a while, you can have some of those past consequences start to show up now.
You know, true.
You have people, you know, you go into a town, they're like, oh, we've heard of you, and we don't want anything to do with you. You're terrifying.
Yeah.
And, you know, they shops close up, the guards watching them all the time. Let them have a reputation for having done these things.
People, like, bar the gates and, you know, scream, you know, just leave us alone or something when they approach the town.
Right.
You
know, yeah. Like, important NPCs just don't want to help them. They raise prices. I mean, just anything you can think of from people having a negative reaction. And it probably shouldn't be everybody, but it needs to be noticeable, and it needs to not be only flavor. It needs to have an adverse effect.
It needs to sting a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what you could very easily say is give them a quest. You have to go to this city and, you know, get this piece of paper signed by this guy. Or get a MacGuffin that's just, you know, laying around on the street. But when they get there, the city's not letting them in. And the reason the city's not letting them in, you just slaughtered an entire race of whatever the thing those things
right.
are, and they were trading with us.
Yeah,
you know,
how do we know you're not here to do that to us?
Yeah, those goblins that you just killed, you murdered, were our chief mining operation. We're out of things. We're not letting you in. And then then the obvious choice is, well, then I'm going to attack the town. And here's what you can do. You can let them attack the town. But once they attack the town, something bigger is coming for them. And then you make that something bigger able to easily go, hi, I'm the king. I'm the king. You just sacked one of my towns. The army's after you.
My only concern there is that you're quickly developing a GM versus the player's arms race, which the GM will always win because he's writing up the stats for the things he's throwing at
and
them.
And it will make the game not fun very quickly.
It quickly, to a certain degree, it's a little bit railroading in that the GM is trying to adjust the decisions the players are making, but it's not, you know, obvious railroading. It's, look, let's get this game back on track and get player decisions back on track to where it should be. I'm afraid that what you're suggesting is quickly going to devolve into a lot of hard feelings.
Yeah, you want to give them an opportunity to avoid things getting quite that bad.
Yeah.
You want to talk to them and then give them a chance to fix things before the whole thing goes, you know, completely sour on them.
True, but the thing is, what I'm thinking about is, if a player, like, okay, either the players know they're doing this or the players don't know they're doing this.
Right, and I'm sort of getting the impression they kind of don't, or they're just getting caught up in the moment, or at least that's how it's always been for me.
Yeah, that's the impression that I was getting too.
And maybe they do know, and we'll address that separately, I guess, but go ahead.
Even if they don't know, then you have to say is whether they care or not when they figure out. Because, like, and so it's way skewed that a talk is a good step, you should have it, but it also can come off like, hey guys, you're not playing my game properly, I want you to play it this way, which is exactly railroady. And what I'll defend with mine is, in my solution, they have a choice. They have a choice of attacking. They're faced with a problem of getting into this town.
Mm-hmm.
What should have been easy is now hard.
Right.
And then you have to find a way around it. And if they say, well, we can't attack the town, then they've learned their lesson and you don't do anything else. And they have another solution and they get in there surreptitiously. And then you pull them aside and say, guys, if you keep acting up and keep, you know, just playing breaking everything, then bad things are going to happen. And you can do it, because that's exactly what evil is. It's the quick, easy solution.
I can see where you're coming from, but the way that you're advocating for seems very passive-aggressive to me.
Well, it is, but also the other problem I see is you're sort of trying to fix the problem by throwing more of the same at them. You're saying, hey, here's a problem you guys can solve by massacring everybody.
Yeah. Or at least that's going to be the, you know, the,
that's how I think it might be perceived, if, actually. That, yeah, you, I think
you
that's
know
a good
what,
point.
What else might be really good here is give them a problem that they just absolutely cannot solve with violence. Put them in a town and have a plague hit or have a natural disaster occur. And be like, look, all these people are going to die unless you guys do something. You know, you're the powerful adventurers. You've got magic. You've got way higher strength scores. You know, you can dig people out of rubble. You can, you know, keep buildings from collapsing. You can, you know, push the floodwaters back. Do something, or you're going to have a whole bunch of dead civilians on your hands.
Right.
And see what they do in that situation. And throw a few of those at them, because then it's still something exciting. But it gets them in the habit of solving problems with something other than just mashing it.
But see, this is where I'm getting at. Like, I know I've brought this up in future episodes about how you seem to have played with a whole lot better people than I have. Because in games where in systems that I've played in with people I've run with, if I threw a natural disaster at them, they'd say, oh, well, I guess we can loot the town now, or we can get out of the way, you know, and leave them to do whatever it is.
And so trap them with a natural disaster.
My solution for this problem is less about brute force and giving them something, you know, they can't handle or anything like that, and more about using social pressure. Make their characters, or give their characters the opportunity to feel ashamed of actions they've taken. Let there be social pressure in-game, and thus out-of-game, because you have players driving these characters, to say, oh, we really shouldn't have done that. Oh, people disapprove of that. If people are role-playing at all in these games, you know, if it's not a simple hack and slash game, you're going to have a sense that these NPCs are real to at least some little degree. And their feelings, collectively at least, have some impact on the players.
Yeah.
You know, because you've invested time in dealing with them, you know, you've invested time and energy in your characters' relationships with some of these characters. You know, you don't train a puppy not to poop on the carpet by beating it. You rub its nose in it and make it ashamed of having done that. And while I hesitate to compare players to, you know, puppies, the analogy of teaching, you know, of using social pressure as opposed to just, you know, beating them about the head, I think still stands. And so, you know, in the example of like a natural disaster or something like that, I'd say, you know, if they help solve that problem, give them kind of a mixed reputation in the next town. Well, you know, I've heard you guys, you know, did these horrible deeds, but then you saved this town. I don't know what to think about you. You know, let people talk about them both. And if they walk away, like Brandon said, and say, oh, you know, now we can loot the town, maybe the rumors about them are now, you know, these guys caused this flood so they can loot the town. You know, they're that powerful and that scary. You know, if this keeps going, I don't know that in-game solutions are the answer.
Yeah.
But after a, you know, if after a couple of, we're talking about hints here. It's a little passive-aggressive if you don't accompany it with any out-of-game mention, or if this seems to come out of nowhere. You know, if the GM has been trying to run a story-based campaign and he's just sort of been letting this slide, maybe now's the time to bring it back in and let the game take its natural course. Let the story take its natural course. But if it's been a dungeon crawl up till this point, this is going to feel weird.
Yeah, I think also if you're doing a dungeon crawl type game and you don't really like that this is going on, maybe just sit down with your players and say, okay, you know, I know we were sitting down to do just kind of a fun hack and slash thing. The carnage is starting to bother me. So would it be okay with you guys if we switch to something a little more truly heroic and a little more story driven?
Yeah. Or even just say, hey, can we put the kibosh on this right now?
Yeah. Can we switch to something else? Can we maybe just whip out the card games and play Dominion for a few weeks and, you know, come back around at this or something.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the nuclear option right there, which is nuke the game, literally. Destroy it. Say, we're not going to play.
Taking a break, I don't think, is a nuclear option. I think it's taking a break. I mean, you're going to...
In the context of playing that game, it's the nuclear option of don't play the game. Like... Yeah, that's always a solution of if there's something that you can't work, walk away from it. If something just isn't working with you, then excuse yourself from it. I'm a full supporter of that. But from what I see, it is like I guess it's just me and my personal experience that leads me to think that the problem has to be something like, okay, so you go to see the king, all right, I steal his crown. Wait, no, you don't steal his crown. There's guards there. Oh, I can fight the guards. No, you can't fight the guards.
Yeah.
You know,
I think in order for this to be a productive discussion, we have to assume that our listeners, players, are adults and not 12-year-olds, though.
I've seen adults act like that.
Yeah, I have too. You have been very fortunate in your gaming groups, believe me.
Yeah.
I guess so, but... at least adults, you can stop the game and call them on it and there's a decent chance that they will at least sort of listen to you for... Do you see what I'm saying here? I mean, with kids, if you try and have this conversation with them, they're going to snicker at you and do it more. With adults, if you're like, hey guys, not the kind of game I'm trying to run, not cool. Could you maybe approach this in more of a realistic kind of way where, you know, just because you...
absolutely.
World leaders of superpowers do not just deploy the army every time somebody serves them a bad meal. I mean, if the President of the United States goes to the White House kitchen and the chef has a bad night, the guy might get fired, but he's not going to get shot.
Yeah, I'll give you that. The problem is, I think you have been playing with adults, not selfish man-children masquerading as adults. And I have played with a fair number of... the latter. Not my current group, thankfully. But a couple of people who I've had in the past, just you know, we're actually talking about Happy Jack's RPG podcast earlier on. They're very fond of talking about the somewhat Asperger-y nature of our hobby and some of the people in it. That's sort of who I'm
talking
about
here. Doesn't that come down to basically a very simple statement of let's play like adults or let's not play?
It does, but the question is, can we get people to play like adults?
And Brandon, if that's the nuclear option, yeah, I'll mash the red button and smile while I do it, because it's not fun to play with man-children.
So and
like
I
either act like the adults that you are, and let's have an actual mature game, and by that I don't mean all kinds of objectionable content. I mean act with maturity, or let's find something else to do where that doesn't call out these things that I perceive as flaws in your character.
Yeah.
And I don't mean your player character, I mean your personal character.
Right.
And I understand that. I understand that that is a solution, and that might be the solution to the end of it, but it's not the only one, because I've dealt with situations like this in other ways, where I've gotten the person who was acting like a man-child, who, you know, didn't think that there was anything wrong in what he was doing, to see what he was doing and stop. And
okay, well,
like,
hang on. How did you do that? What was the situation there? We've been talking about sort of a generic and slightly imagined situation.
Yeah, some specificity would be very good in this discussion.
Tell me what you did here. Without naming names, obviously.
You don't know any of these people. They were from my old high school. And, I don't know if they listen. Anyway,
they should.
And
what
if they
doing,
do,
man?
If they do listen, they know who they are.
All right, fair
and
enough.
They know what happened. But it was a game that I was hearing about how everyone was some sort of, like, good or lawful.
Mm-hmm.
And they had blown up two towns of good people with carts that were filled with napalm and, like, gunpowder and alchemist fire and nails. And I'm like, this is horrible. So what I did is I joined the game and I played a giant warforged gorilla with an atomic bomb in his chest, so they couldn't kill me. And I was the most evil person there was. My religion was kill everything. I did absolutely horrible things so that when they looked at my character, they didn't want to be him. And the whole point of this character was to shock them back into, you know, acting, you know, in a way that is more in line with a good character. And I didn't have to do it with everyone in the party. I just had to get enough of the party to go, okay, we have to be the good to balance out this.
Yeah.
So if someone else is running wild, then, yeah.
That's interesting because you're doing it from the player's side of things. That might be something you could do as the GM, is talk to one player who you think might be more willing to do something like this, and either A, just, you know, talk to either one player and have them act sort of as a role model, to put it fairly bluntly, or introduce an NPC like that, or have this one, you know, go ahead and let one character be, you know, something really horrible, you know, however you want to get them there, and then let the other players go, ooh, that's not good.
You know what else might work? And I will admit that you have this, in order for this solution to work, you have to have somebody that you trust to be able to play somebody really upstanding, and the person should also be pretty canny and hopefully also well-liked by the other members of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Bring in one more person and tell them that this person is, you're going to spice the game up a little bit, and this person's going to be playing an adversary NPC. Make them about, I don't know, in a D&D type game, about four levels higher than the player group, so that, you know, they're actually a real threat. And have the person play, like, the most noble, honest, upstanding, law-abiding, decent, compassionate, and yet brilliant and tough as nails, like, paladin, law enforcer, king's agent type of person possible.
Mm-hmm.
And have this paragon of virtue hunting them down. And I'm not talking about Miko Miyazaki. I'm, you know, like, if we're going to use Order of the Stick references, sick O'Chul on them.
Yeah. You know, I don't even know that you need to bring in another player for that. You could simply have that
if
be part of
NPC,
what's happened.
I don't think it will have the gravitas.
If you start foreshadowing it, you know, if you have somebody right up out of the blue and say, ah, I'm a lawful good paladin who's been, you know, hunting you, that's not good. But if you start spreading rumors about how, you know, so-and-so, who's this great demon hunter, is looking for somebody, you know, looking for a group of bandits or whatever, and the description matches them, and you start kind of dropping hints and foreshadowing, hey, this is going to happen. When it shows up, I think it'll have more impact. Or, you know, something scary is hunting them, and it turns out to be this lawful good paladin, or an order of knights who hunt down threats.
Or an archangel or something. Yeah.
I don't know about that, simply because it seems contrived, honestly.
Another good thing to foreshadow, I would say, would be their power. Have the group get behind this person. They arrive after they've already left a town, and she's slaying some huge beast. Like, this colossal dragon, whatever thing you want to say, is just laying there. And it's like, yeah, one person took her down, and they were asking about you.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, there's this massive, like, you know, just ugly, toothsome monster just kind of, like, lying there with its tongue hanging out on a hill outside of town. And the townspeople are all kind of, like, standing around poking at it with sticks when the PCs come riding up. Like, what the heck happened here?
Yeah, I like that.
That could be an interesting kind of dramatic thing to...
Yeah, it's good. Actually, something I suggested in the thread where D3M410 originally posted this was, you know, if you've got a group of characters who are acting this way, have an emissary from the main adversary in the story that he's telling, or an adversary, it doesn't have to be the main one. Somebody preferably who's sort of in line with how they've been behaving, to put this in some really simple traditional D&D terms, if they're sort of being chaotic evil, have a chaotic evil entity send them an emissary. If they're sort of on the lawful evil side of things, somebody who's lawful, somebody where it sort of makes sense.
Okay.
Have them send an emissary saying, hey, why are you guys hunting me? Clearly we are on the same side. You've done this and this and this. You seem like natural allies for my cause. Why are you hunting me?
Surely we can work this out and combine our, you know, our efforts.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. You know, let's get this organized and do this right. I think if you can present, let me generalize this a little bit. If you can present to your players the realization that they have been acting basically like the bad guys, and the bad guys
they've been as bad as the devil.
Yeah, you know, that sudden realization of, oh, we're as bad as him, or we're as bad as they are, may help shock them out of it. Maybe. I don't know that that's the perfect way to do it, but I think it's an option. And all of these ultimately are options. You got to kind of test your group out.
Yeah.
You know, see how this is going.
They're not mutually exclusive either, which I think is worth mentioning.
They're not.
We've come to a whole bunch of different solutions for this already. One of them being the talking to people, and while I think that's a good solution, of course you don't want to come out like, hey guys, you're not playing your characters right, because if you're going to say that, like, if I'm going to say that, I might as well write a book.
Yeah, agreed.
Because, yeah, but so I can't control everything the players do, and maybe a player does want to do something a little crazier and out there. We've talked about bringing in another agent and things like that, which I completely agree with, and it's something that I even did in my other game. In the game I have, there was a great little encounter where they encountered a clan of ghouls.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everyone was like, all right, and despite the fact that when they encountered these ghouls, they ran away from them, the guy still attacked them. Not only did they attack him, he knocked one of them out, drug him back, and then the guy put the bomb collar around this guy's neck.
This is in your Shadowrun game, you know, I take it.
Dresden Files.
Dresden, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and it puts a bomb all around the guy's...
I'm used to Mad Bombers being Shadowrun, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Isn't every player character a Mad Bomber in Shadowrun?
It depends on how much C4 and how many drones they have access to.
So, yes.
Yeah, but anyway, I was able to use one of the characters... another one of the aspects to basically change that into a whole anti-party conflict, where I basically put another one of the characters on the other side of the, what's it called, on the monsters, because they invoke certain aspects of this person's character, right, which are pretty clearly designed for that, and when I invoked it, the character swore.
Nice. And you know what? This gets to something that I did want to talk about, which is kind of a metagame solution to this. This is, goes back to something we were talking about very early on in this discussion. I think the rule set you're using can contribute to this sort of behavior. And by the same token, I think changing the rules that you're using and changing the game you're playing a bit, even if it's not, even if you're playing the same campaign, changing some of the rules may be a good idea just to limit things, but I think taking a break from the game and doing something different with a completely different system can break people out of these behavioral ruts. And I say this from personal experience, because my group for the longest time played nothing but D&D 3.5, 3.0 and 3.5. And I was kind of one of these guys, you know, for a long time, because it was the same GM. He told the same story in every game, which was a problem in and of itself, but neither here nor there. And he's gotten a bit better about that.
Boy, I have been lucky, because all of these apparent paragon of virtue players that I've had, this was all 3.5 in the early stages of Pathfinder.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into too much into that, because this guy, listen, he's a great guy, but he has a tendency to kind of fixate on this one story that he's got, and I think he actually did what Brandon suggested, write the book, and so he's been doing that, and he's gotten better since, because he's no longer having to get this story that he's got in his head out through the game.
Gotcha.
But same system, same sort of story, same setting, you know, it's always a fantasy thing, and always his world. When you kind of have everything set up the same way, and you're always playing characters who have somewhat similar abilities. I'm always playing a caster of some sort, you know, something like that. You end up, even if the characters have a few differences, you end up playing them in very similar ways. So, you know, I was doing a lot of this sort of thing, a lot of the stuff that D3M410 is describing here, because that's just what, that's just sort of how you behave when you're playing D&D. And what it took was me joining a different game with the same basic group, but it was a mage game. And I said, okay, this is a different system. It plays differently. And I'd kind of been bored with the D20 system and wanted to try something new anyway.
Yeah, there's a completely different set of setting assumptions for
different setting assumptions over different system. D&D. And the math doesn't work the same way. Everybody's a caster in mage, but it's not the same thing.
You have to be subtle about it, for one thing.
Yes-ish.
For varying definitions of subtle, but yeah.
Yeah, we found it was much easier. Understand, this was a mage game where we had like 300 plus experience points by the end of it, and went, this was the one where the prologue went on for 3 years.
Yes.
Yeah. Neither here nor there. The point is, once you break out of that rut, you can kind of look back on it and go, you know, I don't really want to do this other thing anymore. So, you know, when another D20 game started, I had a completely different take on it because I'd been making something other than this one character the whole time. And it's not, you know, it's not the same character, but you sort of end up playing them the same way.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and it, because it's, you know, it's D&D night. If it were poker night, and we'd been playing poker for years, you know, yeah, okay, the hands are different, and my starting chips are different, and the game plays out differently, but you're always kind of playing the same way with the same people, and the game always kind of plays out the same way, you know?
We have to admit that is part of the fun. You know, there's a comfortable familiarity in gaming, and you don't want to totally take that away when you're trying to solve these problems.
Right. But I think taking a break and doing something different, play a fate game or something where the GM has the opportunity to use compels and, you know, where the system is so radically different and the characters that are made are so radically different that they have to break out of this character creation rut and the character behavior rut.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Different setting where instead of fantasy, it's pulp, hard science fiction with no fantastical science fiction elements, you know, no psychics, no warp travel, things like that, you know. So honestly, I'm thinking here Spirit of the Century or Diaspora or something like that.
Another fate game.
You could even probably
just play fate constantly,
dial this this and contribute to the Kickstarter, and yeah, it's
exactly.
Nothing but fate. It's
right.
It is an awfully elegant system. Anyway,
it is. But, you know, play something like Fiasco, where the character creation system is, let's roll on a table, come up with things that will generate conflict, and just act.
Wait a second. Did you actually just suggest that people learn to play better people by playing a game of Fiasco?
I'm saying learn how to play different people. That's really what it is. Fiasco does not cause
listeners,
you to play.
Listeners, you cannot see me looking at him dubiously, but I am looking at him dubiously.
I should clarify. Jeb, actually, Thud on the Fear the Boot forums and one of the hosts on Postcards from the Dungeon, he played someone who was really a pretty good guy in the Fiasco game that he chaired at Fear the Con 5. Now, admittedly, I played a truly terrible person, but, you know, that's the way of it.
And was he the first to die?
He was the only person to die.
Yeah, oh, no. I think my case stands.
Yes, that's right. Because his co-host blew him up with a stick of dynamite after I shot him. Fiasco's like that sometimes.
I'm just going to let this settle for a few seconds here.
But the point is, if you play something with radically different mechanics and character creation and rules, and just if everything's different, you're going to end up breaking out of that mold.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I can, you know what might also actually be kind of cool if you've got characters that are playing Stabby McHomicide, throw them into a superheroes game.
Yeah. I'm just afraid you'll end up with Disproportionate Response Man.
Maybe, but I think it's Disproportionate Response Man.
I have to admit, I stole that entirely from Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, but it's just, it's a wonderful mental image.
Now I'm picturing what this guy's costume must look like, but, the thing is, superheroes are supposed to be all about, and I admit that you can't do like a 90s dark anti-hero game or you're going to wind up with the same exact thing.
Yeah, no
but
Frank
But if you
Miller.
Do like, yeah, if you do like, oh, or Jim Lee or especially Rob Liefeld, but if you do like a traditional, I don't know, Golden Age or Silver Age kind of heroic, kind of quasi-swashbuckling kind of thing, I think maybe that would be enough. Or heck, to an actual, like, Adventure on the High Seas pulpy swashbuckling game, you know, kind of take the Fate idea and use Spirit of the Century to dial it back to the Age of Sail a little bit and have some of the fun be, like, finding all this weird exotic stuff out there, you know?
Right. Just,
or do you want to know the best solution?
Yes.
Just take Aspects. Aspects, every system, all the time.
I do like the Aspect mechanic that Fate uses.
I don't think it's a total panacea, but I do think you have a point.
Yeah.
I mean, the solutions that I were able to pull off in the Dresden Files game with very little prompting were due because A, I had some really good characters, and B, because I could throw chips at them and say, act this way. And, you know, or your character should act this way, and you're getting rewarded for it.
Right.
Because it's not really railroading because they made this character. And, you know, they have the choice of paying off the chip and throwing it away and acting however they want. But it also is a little token that goes, hey, don't just, you know, shoot the king because he has a pretty crown, you know, when you're the lawful good paladin. It's like,
well, you know, that actually brings up another point. If you are playing like a D&D style game and one or more of your characters has some kind of class ability that hinges on their maintaining a certain minimum level of virtue, take it away when they drop below that. That is totally in keeping with the way the game is supposed to go.
Yeah.
And make it really hard for them to get it back.
And don't forget, too, that very often those codes of conduct involve not just your personal behavior, but the behavior of those you associate with. It's one of the reasons the paladin is, you know, traditionally considered so annoying. It's incumbent on him to be a moral leader of the party, not just the moral high ground in the party.
Well, then you get the problem of no player wants to be the, you know, like you've got a party of five rogues and Debbie Downer. Like,
I'll grant you that, but even if it's anything that draws its power from a divine power source in D&D, and this is sort of a D&D specific thing, but you can generalize it to your own game. Anything that involves drawing power from something like that, if you've got a lawful good cleric, yeah, it's not in the rules, but it's strongly implied in the setting.
Well, and their church hierarchy can start censuring them too. You don't necessarily have to say you wake up with no spells this morning. It's, you have a boss. Do you guys think it's wise to, this is a somewhat leading question, obviously, but do you think it's wise to start treating these people like they're actually doing something bad in the real world at some point?
What do you mean?
I'm not really trying to hide any meaning in that sentence, but take it at face value.
Then I did not follow.
Yeah, okay, I didn't follow either. Like, are we talking about calling the cops on them? Because
I'm thinking more like acting with genuine moral outrage at the table, like, you know, kind of just stopping play and being like, seriously, you know, what kind of a person are you where you would even think that?
That's destroying fun. Like, that is the biggest sledgehammer to fun in the world.
Yeah.
And while it might be necessary, if my GM starts yelling at me for playing my character,
The thing is, I get the impression that he's not, that these guys, A, aren't playing their character, and B, the GM doesn't seem to be having that much fun either.
Yeah, well, and let me jump in real quick here and say that that answer that I got from you, Brandon, is about what I was going for. I think you want to address this with a certain amount of finesse, and treating these people like they're committing the acts that their characters are committing in real life is going to be counterproductive.
Yeah.
I just wanted to call that out a little bit in this episode, so that's kind of on the record.
Yeah.
It's sort of a worst case thing.
Now, that said, if what your players are doing is so bad that it's actually making you as a human uncomfortable, you definitely need to have a conversation about that with them.
Yeah, we talk about lines and veils a fair bit on the show. The GM has those too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's important to remember
that GM has those. In fact, I think sometimes the GM has those more intensely than a lot of the players do.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the GM, first of all, you need to make it clear to the players, hey, you know, from the outset, these are my expectations as well. I don't, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this, but that's something you kind of have to do at the start of the game. Maybe
is
remind
it?
Them.
Well, or can you bring the stuff up if something that you never expected kind of crops up unexpectedly?
I think you can bring it up.
Oh, yeah. No, at the beginning of the game is the only time you're ever able to talk to the GM out of character.
Really?
I've
been doing it wrong this whole time.
Yes, they need to put him in a little steel box, and he will sit there and he will deliver plot through the box, and when he needs to roll, the dice will come out, you have the little chute, so everyone can see them, and no one can touch him, and no one can approach him.
I've been doing this completely incorrectly for my entire gaming career.
Well, so this is
everything
why I love
I
being
know
a GM.
Is wrong.
Fair enough.
This is why I love
Mind
being a GM,
blown.
Because I can smile at you.
We're obviously joking, listeners.
Yes, don't put your GM in a steel box.
Yes, please. Especially if the GM
unless
suffers
he's been
from
really,
claustrophobia.
Really horrible at running the games, then definitely do it.
And by a steel box in that case, we mean his car and send him home.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, we've sort of been dancing around this, I think, a little bit. I think it's okay as the GM to say, look, guys, this is bothering me. We've got to stop it. It's bothering me on a personal level. Because that's something anybody in any group should feel comfortable saying at any point.
Yeah, these are your friends. I mean, you do have the right to say, hey, guys, not cool.
Yeah.
Seriously,
well,
not cool.
Well, okay, you're sort of assuming these are friends. You know, the pickup
game... If they're not, why are you gaming with them?
Well, the pickup game at the game store is still a thing, you know?
What's it called? Pen and paper, a roleplay gamer. I almost joined a game from there and went to another person's house.
Yeah.
I would have been the outsider. There are people who play with people who they don't know. I've played games with Trigger Happy and a couple other Fear the Boot people. I wouldn't call them necessarily friends.
I've met some friends through gaming, so I suppose we all do that occasionally, but if you're continuing to game with them, you've got a friendship at least germinating, I would think.
There are a lot of people who don't have a group of nearby friends, and their only gaming outlet is local game connections and, you know, the bulletin board at the game store or pickup games at the game store or something like that. You know, the internet has helped a lot. But
here's my counterpoint to that. If you are in a game and if you discover very quickly that you don't want anything to do with these people, why do you continue to game with them?
That's something to do.
It's something to do on Sunday or Saturday or whatever.
And I agree with you that we probably should be stronger than that. But there's a lot of cases where...
Steam, game online with the friends that you do have.
Listen, I agree with you. And I think if you're not comfortable, walk away.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's something where it's sort of borderline, where it's, you know, hey, this has started kind of going downhill, you know,
they're
not
the
your
muddy
friends.
Waters of uncertainty. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead and talk to them. You know, because, yes, okay. They may not be your friends, but, you know, you've put up with them for this long. Presumably you're having fun with them. I think if you aren't having fun, go find something better to do with your time. We're in this hobby for fun.
Yeah, if they're not your friends and you're not having fun, you have completely removed all logical reason to be there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important to protect that fun. And if the content of the game starts making you uncomfortable and you're not having fun, do something about it. But I think there's a sense that, well, I've sunk all of this time into this game already. I've sunk all this time into this group. You know, it's... I'll show up anyway. You know, I've seen that happen.
I think that's a good way to keep yourself in a miserable situation.
It is.
If you've sunk all this time in and things are bad, you don't want to sink any more in. I mean, you've already put in too much.
You're
at that
right,
point.
And that's why, you know, the sunk costs argument is a logical fallacy, but it is nonetheless a convincing fallacy to some people. You know, people will do that. And what I'm saying is, guys, don't do that. It's okay to say, you know, I can stop this. I can walk away. I don't care that I've spent the past 3 months coming here. I've stopped having fun. I can say, no, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not right, but it happens.
Yeah. Or you can say, you know, go ahead. And there, if you feel like you need to walk away and you're kind of planning on walking away from it because you're not feeling comfortable with it, that is a good time to say, guys, this is why I'm not comfortable with this. If they don't agree to change anything, well, you're going to walk away anyway. If they do, well, maybe you can start enjoying the game again.
Yeah, very true. Excellent point, actually.
Now, to kind of pull it back to this original post here, it sounds like, you know, this guy is gaming with friends. You know, they said that they're all people that know each other through church.
And if you've got your gaming group through church, with as much as role-playing is kind of still stigmatized as we've addressed in earlier podcasts, you're probably at least passingly close with these people to have kind of all trusted each other enough to kind of come out of the gamer closet to each other. So
I think it's okay also to lean on that church connection in this particular case and say, guys, listen, we're all Presbyterians or Baptists or whatever. None of this really reflects that.
Yeah, it's like, come on, guys, I know you from church. This is making me uncomfortable. Can we dial it back a little?
Yeah.
Well, true, but there's also a thing you have to think about from the other side, is we've been talking about how this is affecting the Game Master. You also have to think about how it's affecting the players. Like, and it could, and because honestly, most of these problems boil down to one thing: bad communication. Where it could be that this guy isn't meaning to mess everything up or things like that, but he knows exactly what he's doing. He just wants to kill some orcs. He wants to have fun, he doesn't want to care, and this is how he's stress relieving. And it's...
You know what I think the perfect solution to that problem would be?
Video games?
No, not even video games. I mean, yes, that is one, you know, perfect solution. But I think if he wants to do it in the context of the game, you can kind of sit down as a table and come to an accord. I mean, it's a social activity, so it's all about compromise on some level, right?
Yeah.
So you sit down with your players and say, look, I know you really enjoy the hack and slash stuff, and I as a GM promise to give you ample opportunity to just cut loose and show how awesome you are in combat. If when that's not going on and you're not fighting off the, you know, the horde of the undead that's trying to sack the town, if you actually act like good people that want to keep the people in the town safe.
Mm-hmm. And you know what might help? You may want to actually have two games running concurrently. One hack and slash to scratch that itch, and another really story-focused game. And that,
yeah,
that does
true.
Two things. First, you get the hack and slash out of your system, as it were. And that satisfies that itch. Because, listen, numbers are fun, and rolling lots of dice is fun, and doing big, crunchy things is fun. All right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can do stuff at a tabletop game that you could never pull off in Torchlight.
Exactly.
Just because it's, you know, it's so much more versatile. You can kind of...
Well, I can jump up on a railing and attack something. I can't do that in a video game.
You're limited by your imagination rather than by the constraints of the game engine.
Exactly.
So I totally get having fun with an action-heavy hack-and-slash game.
Right. So have your hack-and-slash game every other week, and then the intervening weeks, have a really story-focused game. Maybe this game. Kind of do a little bit of a reset if you have to or something like that, and get back to this
game. Or make this game into the hack-and-slash game and start up another one.
Whichever way you want to do it. And kind of divide that up so that you, first of all, again, like I said before, it breaks them out of that rut. you have different characters, you have something else going on, and then you still have that satisfying hack and slash action going on. Maybe that would work. Or, you know, here's another option. You got somebody who's kind of being a problem player. You know, one of the best ways to fix a problem player? Make them a GM for a little while. Let them run a game.
Yeah.
Or co-opt him.
Yeah.
You know, give him something. A lot of the time, problem players want some attention. So give him some special attention. Give him some extra responsibility to go with it.
Yeah.
Bring him in instead of pushing him out. And a lot of the time, that'll go away.
And that's a good point. We've kind of been assuming that this is all sort of all the players acting as one. If it's one problem player, you can maybe do that, you know, or again, put them in the GM chair and say, hey, do you want to run a game like this? And because nothing teaches good playing habits like GMing and having to deal with all these bad player habits.
Oh, heck no. that is the best way to learn. It is a trial by fire, but it is very effective.
Yeah.
So I guess what the first thing, if you're dealing with a problem player, is to try to figure out what kind of problem player this person is.
Right.
Is this the clueless guy who doesn't know he's causing a problem? The immature man child who's throwing a temper tantrum and wants, you know, a little attention? Or is it the Joker who just wants to watch the world burn? And then you have to go from there. Yeah. As to
there's a great little phrase that I remember from a friend's t-shirt, actually. Don't attribute to malice what stupidity can explain. Or oblivious. I'm going to add obliviousness, or, you know, just not thinking it through to that. But it's a lot of the time people are not doing stuff just to be jerks. They're just doing it because they haven't thought it through.
Yeah. That's a
Peter.
Few people do stuff intentionally to be jerks.
Peter, you are right, but there are a whole bunch more people out there who just do things just to be jerks than I think you know, because I've seen
them. Work in retail. Try me.
Okay, fine. Anyway, so we don't have a who's seen more jerks competition. Is there anything else that we want to say on this topic?
I don't know that I have a lot more to say on this other than recognize that it may take a couple of tries to get the players to realize, oh, this really is sort of a problem.
You know what I would suggest as kind of a final thing for me on this? Go back through the episode, write down every idea that you think sounds good or any other ones that come to your mind from listening to that or other resources that you have. I'm certainly not going to claim any kind of a monopoly on wisdom here. And like three of them at once. You know,
yeah.
Go ahead and be kind of, you know, multi-pronged and heavy-handed about this. If it's a real problem, you don't have to try just one solution at a time until something works or you've exhausted the list. Grab the three or four things that you think are going to be the most promising in and out of game and throw them all in at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to suggest doing an in-game and out-of-game solution at the same time. That's a good idea.
And be honest about what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, don't try and... If somebody calls you on this, don't try and be like, oh, no, it's just the way the story plays out. Go ahead and say, yeah, this is kind of bothering me, and I figured, you know, it's time to make the game world reflect, hey, this is not how heroes or whatever your characters are trying to be, how your characters should behave and that sort of thing.
See,
lying to
or even just have the conversation first, sit down and say, just so you know, what I just told you is going to have effects on the way that the game is played. So keep that in mind. All right, let's start our session, you know, and pull up
I think being upfront and honest is a good thing. Like, there is a certain point where I think, like, and this is kind of getting to the little nitty-gritties of players, but there could be certain players who then use that against you. And then those people require heavier sticks, basically. Like,
but you never want to start out with the assumption that they're going to be bad about it.
Yeah,
you want to give them a chance to do the right thing.
Yeah, and I'm saying if they call you on it, you don't want to lie to them. You know, lying to your players is obviously not a good thing.
No.
Yeah, Peter, I think your suggestion of trying a couple of these at a time is a good idea. You know, I just thought of something else as well. again, this sort of gets into sort of breaking people out of their gaming rut. Invite someone else to sit in on the game. Not necessarily to play it, but if people are used to behaving a certain way in front of all of, you know, this same group of people, having someone else in the room with them, just their presence and them listening in may make them behave differently.
That's an excellent point.
Get your girlfriend or wife or whatever to sit in with you and, you know, just have them there.
Or a boyfriend or husband. I mean, there's plenty of female GMs, too.
You're right. Sorry. I am making an assumption there. It's hard having three white bearded guys on one podcast.
Yes, the three
our perspective
white guys
is
podcast.
Slightly limited.
if you want a perspective that is not bearded white guy, you have come to the wrong podcast.
Unfortunately, I don't know. We'll have to try and fix that at some point. But
I'm not shaving.
anyway,
but yeah, I think having an outside observer just to make people behave a little bit differently may work. Again, judge your group accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to say, like, back in the beginning of the episode with the whole in-game fixes, the most important thing to do is to make them, fit with the world. Just because you are throwing this in here as a reaction to how the players are acting doesn't mean that it should be obvious that, like, a dragon's coming down in your path.
Yeah, it's got to be internally consistent. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's and if it's not internally consistent, then you create a bigger problem and people will call you for railroading.
Yeah.
But if they come to a town and this guy goes, well, this is just BS. You're just doing this to us because we destroyed that town and you don't like it. You can say, yes, I am. But it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And that's actually, I think, Peter, I think you threw out the idea of like an archangel or something coming down to punish them or something like that or hunt them down. That's why that bothered me. It just sort of seemed literally kind of come out of the blue. Didn't seem consistent.
The reason why I mentioned Archangel is I had no idea how high level they were.
Yeah. Okay,
if you're in like the level 1 through 5 range, like a sheriff or a knight or something is appropriate. If you're in the level 17 to 25 range, it's going to take an Archangel. You're playing at that level. You're swinging at that weight class.
Fair enough.
And then that gets back into the whole foreshadowing thing that we talked about is, it's okay to throw an archangel, you just have to tell them beforehand that it's going to be an archangel.
Yeah, go ahead. You want to... foreshadowing makes it internally consistent. If you...
Yes.
It doesn't come out of the blue, you know, it's not a deus ex machina sort of thing.
Yeah
I think you're right. Okay. Well, I think that's a lot of advice. I do want to encourage anybody who's listening to this, to go ahead and post your suggestions as well, both for D3M410's original problem, as well as any similar problems you have encountered or been a part of, because real-world advice is always the best sort, because you can sort of say, well, this is how it played out when I tried this. Go ahead and post those. Blog comments, Facebook, Google+, Twitter, whatever you prefer. We've got all of them. Our website, savingthegamepodcast.org, it's got all of them available to you.
Yeah, and if this generates sufficient response, I would not mind coming back and readdressing this when we've got some more specific feedback from people.
Oh, yeah. No, that'd be... I think we may well do that even as, you know, a subtopic in an episode, you know, read off some of the best responses we get and that sort of thing. I think we probably should. On that note,
I still say the best way to deal with players behaving badly is to give them a big old chunk of coal in their stocking.
That's true. That works, unless it's a snowman and he needs coal for eyes.
Or it's really cold where they live and they're just going to burn the coal for fuel.
That's right.
One thing that I have always thought was really cool about that particular part of the Santa tradition is even if you are bad, you're still going to be warm in the winter.
That's true.
there's a certain level of compassion there where it's like, okay, you don't get anything special, but I'm not going to let you freeze.
Yeah, there is that.
Nice little picture of kind of mercy and compassion there.
On the other hand, you have a whole bunch of coal dust in your sock.
This is true. You're going to be warm, but your foot's going to be itchy.
It's going to be itchy and probably dirty. Black. Yeah, it's going to be awful. All right. Well, folks, I think that's about it from us. Merry Christmas from all of us.
Yes, Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, whatever you else is
yes,
out there.
Happy other holidays that we have accidentally neglected. And Happy New Year, too, probably. I think that's going to be it from us.
Thank you for joining us tonight, folks. I know we were all kind of in rare form tonight, and maybe undercooked form is a better way of putting it.
Oh, who knows? We'll make it work.
Oh, you...
That's why it's why I edit.
Good night, everybody.
Night, folks.
Good night, everyone.
This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.